Well, hello and welcome to another episode of the Capitol Record. And I am very excited today to be introducing as our special guest and first-time guest, Andy Puzder, who is the former chief executive of CKE Restaurants, or as we know it here on the West Coast, Carl's Jr., as many know it around the country, Hardee's. But Andy was Carl Karcher, the founder of Carl's Jr. He was his personal attorney for a long, long time and became CEO of the company and guided it through an incredibly difficult period financially, expanded the company to over 3,800 restaurants, and retired as one of the most successful corporate executives of the last 20 years, and now has done something that I see so rarely in corporate executive world, is he's decided to use this stage of his life and career as a defender of the things that made him so successful, not as a critic of the things that made him so successful. And what I mean by that is he frequently lectures in defense of free enterprise, in defense of capital markets. He serves as a board member and advisor and fellow at a number of colleges and think tanks and organizations. He has written in National Review's Capital Matters. He was a whisker away from becoming the Secretary of Labor in the Trump administration, and is still to this day a renowned policy advisor. And again, what you're going to see here from Andy is that not only did he have strong business and legal acumen, was a tremendous operator and a success story in the world of free enterprise, but he is a thinker who cares about the principles that drive prosperity in a society. And therefore, he's a perfect guest for Capitol Record. Please join me in welcoming to our podcast, Andy Puzder. And with that said, welcome to another episode of Capitol Record, our special guest, Andy Puzder. Andy, thank you for joining us on Capitol Record.
Pleasure to be here, David. Thank you for having me.
Well, in this particular case, it's interesting, Andy, because I've talked about how our guests on Capitol Record are often business leaders, entrepreneurs, those that are engaged in capital markets, have a kind of macroeconomic expertise, sometimes policy advisors. So we've gone, in a lot of different directions, Wall Street names to Fortune 500 names, and even into just kind of economic analysts. But in a lot of ways, the way I think about you and what I've gotten to know about you and your work over the years, you check a handful of those different boxes. Of course, in a better world, would have been the Secretary of Labor in the Trump administration. You have been in various advisory posts, but obviously corporate executive as CEO of a major American company. And so you have an interesting perspective on what you see out in corporate America in the society at large and what's taking place in our economic milieu. And I wonder if you'd comment on what you think the American attitude is right now towards free enterprise. My general take is that Americans are better than ever at benefiting from free enterprise and maybe getting worse than ever at appreciating it.
Yeah, or defending it. I think they're not particularly good at defending it, particularly people who've made incredible amounts of money, like a Jeff Bezos, or a Bill Gates, who really made tremendous amounts of money, not by stealing from us as you would in a socialist or a totalitarian economy, but really by tremendously benefiting a tremendous number of people. The way you get rich in a free market economy is if you benefit others, you provide them the goods or services they want at a price they can afford. And the greater the benefits you provide, obviously, the wealthier you get. So despite the fact that they've attained this incredible wealth, they don't seem to respect the system that got them there or want other people to take advantage of that system. And that's really very, very unfortunate. We are a freedom-loving country that's enjoyed great personal liberty and economic freedom now for a couple of centuries. And as Ronald Reagan said, we're always just one generation away from losing that freedom. And I'm hoping this isn't that generation, because it would be a real tragedy.
We've had guests on the podcast that have disagreed with me about this. My general take has been that we're those of us who do value free enterprise, believe in capital markets, believe in the different ingredients that are necessary to the machine of free enterprise, that we know who the opponent is on the left, that there is a an increasingly popular faction of the left of radical progressivism, your Bernies and your AOCs and your Elizabeth Warrens, who are fundamentally opposed to the things that we believe in. And I do believe that there's a different group that we're having to contend with now who would identify as being on the right, and yet they are growing in a skepticism about markets, becoming somewhat critical of what they call market orthodoxy. Sometimes they're even coming from a religious perspective, and the so-called Catholic integralism. Is there a need not only to defend what we believe and the good it does for humanity, the prosperity it's generated for society, not just with left-leaning college kids and the probably unreachable Warrens and Sanders and AOCs of the Senate and House, but do we need to even do a better job defending our viewpoint with folks that would seem to be kindred spirits?
Yes, we do. And there is a broad-based attack on free market capitalism, which is unfortunate because, as I said, the only way you succeed in a free market capitalist economy is by meeting the needs of other people. I mean, it really is an economic system that encourages meeting other people's needs, being very egalitarian, being very generous. You really want to satisfy other people as the way to improve your life, which is an incredible system. And it is on attack on many fronts. For example, the shareholder stakeholder capitalism issue, which seems like you've got people out there, these stakeholder capitalists that are attacking the free market system. But really, they act just like capitalists when they are implementing policies representing their companies. They just talk like they're not real capitalists when they're out there trying to advocate these problems. For example, Jamie Dimon and the crew at the Business Roundtable, 186 prominent CEOs that signed a statement saying that we're no longer going to just focus on profits and return for those shareholders, those people that invest money with us. Now we're going to focus on not only shareholders, but our employees, our customers, our suppliers, and our communities. Well, in reality, none of the people who signed that statement then went out at their next report to the financial community and said, we focused on these other people. We lost a bunch of money. It's going to cost us. Your shares are going to be worth less. But hey, aren't we good guys? That's a good way to lose your job. And the reason is because what they're talking about, even with shareholder capitalism, these four categories they're going to focus on are just BS. For example, employees. What idiot CEO wouldn't focus on his employees? They're your most valuable asset. Or customers. What CEO doesn't focus on customers? You can't make a profit without focusing on customers. You focus on your suppliers, obviously, because if you don't focus on your suppliers, guess what they do? They supply your competitors. Yeah. And particularly like during a pandemic, that could be a problem. And then you've got your community, and every CEO knows you need to be well-liked in your community. So really, I think this stakeholder capitalism, woke capitalism, is in many cases just a dodge to try and make people appear like they're in with the in crowd, this group of elitists that are trying to push these progressive ideas down on us, either through our economic system or through leaders like AOC or Bernie Sanders. They want to look like they're kind of answering those people, but at the same time, just be regular capitalists. So they're not out there defending capitalism. They're kind of buying into the left's ideals of capitalism. Like Ronald Reagan, I quote Ronald Reagan again. I guess I do this a lot. Businesses that don't ignore the people are being attacked by are like the guy who's feeding the crocodile because he hopes it'll eat him last. Yeah. They're gonna come after you.
Yeah. Well, and so the term that I think you're describing is virtue signaling, right? And this has become such a key part of leftist methodology. They don't have to really do anything. They can just sort of signal a few things. I think in the best case, it's just pharisaical tokenism. And in the worst case, it's crass marketing. I think Wall Street, it's amazing to me. When I was a managing director at Morgan Stanley, they had a day that they called LGBTQ Day or something. And then it became like a week. And now they do a whole month, you know. And it's sort of like these things, whatever. But it's fine. I get they're trying to portray this thing of how inclusive they are. But at the end of the day, I am totally with you that guys like Jamie Dimon, this is sort of checking a box. They don't believe it. And as you just pointed out, and I swear it's funny, some of the people listening are going to know, it's almost as if I gave a speech on this topic where I said all four of the things you just said, that in the shareholder model of capitalism, where there's a fiduciary duty to the equity holders who have funded the ownership of the business, that model requires you to care for employees and suppliers and the community and whatnot, all the labels that you just talked about, in self-interest, that there has to be that room in self-interest. Now, if we're talking about something even beyond self-interest, this sort of genuine love and compassion and selflessness, well, there's no criteria that can be accomplished in a legal code for that anyways, right? I want people to genuinely care for their employees, but other than the standard of care that is going to make them want to keep working there, I don't know what legally we're even talking about. Like we're getting to a point of absurdity.
Well, we are. You know, just think about it. Now you've got, let's take Amazon. Amazon signed on to that business roundtable statement that they're going to focus on these other groups, including employees. What happened when Amazon's employees wanted to unionize? Did Amazon say, you know what, our labor costs are going to go up, but this is really a good thing for you, so we're just going to go along with it? No, they fought them tooth and nail. Or how about Starbucks, another one of these progressive companies? Their employees want to unionize. So what does Starbucks do? Well, they fight it tooth and nail. They don't go to their shareholders and say, you know what, labor costs are going to increase, your shares are going to be worth less, but gosh, we're really good guys. No, they go, they argue about how much money they're making or going to make, and they do everything they can to keep those employees out of the unions. This is, or let's take Nike. You know, there are companies for which being woke is a good idea. Nike, Patagonia, Starbucks. And look at Nike. They come out with this Colin Kaepernick ad. And when the Colin Kaepernick ad is done, right, when, you know, they took this very controversial woke figure and they use him in an ad, they didn't report to their shareholders and say, you know, we used Kaepernick in an ad. It didn't work. Sales went down. No, it was an ad that appealed to their target market. And when they talked to the financial community, they said, we're making more money based on this ad. So it really is an attempt to look woke in many cases, an attempt to appear like you're towing the line, you know, sort of following the shepherd, the leader of the sheep, when you're really just trying to make money for your shareholders. And so I don't think woke capitalism and stakeholder capitalism are a real threat to capitalism. I think they're just marketing ploys.
Yeah.
Now, there is another real threat out there, which you and I've talked about, which is this ESG investing threat. I think that really is a legitimate threat. But woke capitalism and stakeholder capitalism, they're just trying to, you know, I don't know, put a dress on a pig.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I wonder, too, what would happen if we said that all companies who have signed that 186-person stakeholder capitalism manifesto, if they had to put in bold letters on their 10-Qs every quarter on the front page, we no longer view you, the shareholder, as our fiduciary responsibility. I think it would be very interesting to see what kind of capital raise could take place if they led with a sort of codification of the BS that they're trying to embody in these little surveys.
That's a great idea. Maybe after 2024, when we get a Republican guy in it, a commissioner at the SEC, maybe we should go for that. That's not a bad idea. I kind of like that.
Yeah, it's something to think about. So you say ESG is more of a real threat than a virtue signaling threat. So I've heard a lecture you've recently given on the topic. At National Review Capital Matters, we write about this all the time. I'm of the view that there's still a marketing angle on this ESG stuff as well, but that there is also real meat on the bone with the angle I know you're going to want to talk about. But I've been bringing this up quite a bit lately because we're living in a time where energy is up over 30% on the year and the market is down over 10%, and where last year energy was the top performing sector in the market. My view is that when ESG investing went from about $30 billion in assets to $3 trillion, that it coincided, and I mean as the word sounds, coincidentally, with a time period in which the U.S. energy sector had gotten frothy in valuation. We were dealing with too much supply and too little demand. And we had a few year period that culminated, obviously, in COVID, the ultimate demand deterioration. And so the performance of fossil oriented companies happened to be such that it made the ESG phenomena look good. And now ESG investing is at a crossroads because I'm not sure these pension funds and in some cases hedge funds and certainly a lot of retail investors, I'm not sure that the virtue signaling, self-righteous Phariseeism of ESG can hold up to a huge outperformance where previously they had the benefit of it being the opposite. The tides are turning.
You know, there was a the person who used to run ESG, and just so everybody listening knows, of course, ESG stands for environmental, social justice, and corporate governance investing. And it's investment criteria that really advances a progressive political agenda. You don't need to know what's actually included because they make it up as they go along. It's whatever progressives are pushing. And the person who ran this for BlackRock, which is the largest investment firm in the country, the largest fund manager in the country, in the world, they manage $10 trillion, which is about half of our annual GDP, but $10 trillion. And are the first, second, or third largest shareholder in 80% of the companies in the S&P 500. So a monster. Tariq Fancy, who ran that,
Andy, is worth pointing out that that is largely because of their ETF business, that they have such a massive passive franchise with exchange-traded funds, the former iShares brand, that that's responsible for many trillions of their size and power and conglomeration.
Yeah, it's all indexing. It's all it's not like they're out there picking stocks. It's all right. Indexing. Yeah. And coincidentally, when indexing became very popular, it gave them tremendous power. It gave this incredible power because they could vote all of these shares they're buying with other people's money. So you take red state pension funds, you know, your investment portfolio, my investment portfolio, all of us have money invested with BlackRock, and they vote those shares against our economic interests. Now, Tariq Fancy, who ran sustainable investing at BlackRock, came out with an article that said, hey, look, environmental investing just isn't as profitable as non-environmental related investing. Like, we needed somebody to tell us that high cost environmental projects were going to be less profitable than lower cost non-environmental, non-green projects. But he was out there, he actually made that admission. BlackRock has kind of backed off the hard push on these environmental projects. They're really not trying to accomplish a social good here. What they're trying to do is they're trying to get around the political process in this country so that they can use our money and vote our shares and put pressure on the CEOs of various companies across the country to try and change the policies their companies are pursuing to get things done that you couldn't get done legislatively, like these radical environmental policies that nobody would agree to. Larry Fink, who runs BlackRock, has been out there lecturing CEOs about how they needed to adopt the policies that he preferred. And you're right, it's not as profitable, but do you need an economist to tell you that high cost, low return environmental policies aren't going to be as profitable? Do you need an economist to tell you that companies that focus on political and social issues rather than profits aren't going to be as profitable as companies that focus on profits? I mean, these are obvious that you really don't need an expert to tell you that. They've been pursuing these policies for political reasons and not to help their shareholders, not to advance the economy. And if they coincidentally do well in a particular market, well, that's great. But that isn't going to last, and it isn't lasting right now. I mean, they're facing real issues.
So do you think that the real danger with ESG is intellectual, that it continues to create a mindset for Americans that the profit motive is evil, that effective stewardship of assets, the allocation of scarce resources, that these are all bad things, and that the social justice world ought to be manipulating the way in which capital is allocated? Is that the danger of ESG, or is it more the concentration of power you refer to at companies like BlackRock? What would be the thing that keeps you up at night on this subject, Andy?
Well, it would be the concentration of power. Although I think what you just mentioned is a big danger, and it's a problem. We mentioned it earlier in the show about how people need to defend capitalism more effectively. But the real, let me give you an example. Exxon, largest energy company in the country, right? If you take BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard, which are the three largest of these fund managers combined, by the way, combined, they're the number one shareholder in 80% of the companies in the S&P 500, number one. So they can put incredible pressure on CEOs. But they owned 21% of the shares of Exxon. There was an insurgent that owned very, very few shares, Engine Number One, who decided they wanted to put environmentalists on Exxon's board. Now, Exxon's board opposed having environmentalists on the board because it's in the oil business. And oil prices are going up, demand is surging. They really want to invest in their business and see what they can do with this with increased oil production. Well, this insurgent decides he wants to put this hedge fund decides it wants to put environmentalists on Exxon's board. And guess who supports him? BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard. And guess what happened? Well, today, those environmentalists are sitting on Exxon's board, and the CEO of that company is having to deal with them. Now, how do you think other companies in the country feel when Larry Fink comes in and meets with them and tells them what their policies ought to be? Well, what they think is, my God, I could be the next Exxon. You know, he could be putting directors on my board that oppose the profitability of my company, oppose the goals and missions of my company that aren't in the best interest of my investors. They could be supporting shareholder resolutions that aren't in the best interest of my investors. So there is a real power. It's not only the power to vote, it's the power to go in and say, do what I say, or I could vote. You know, and I think that's a lot of what drives companies like Disney, who's now doing really crazy, stupid things, or American Express, or even Coca-Cola, who, you know, went and opposed the Georgia voting law, adopted these critical race theory human resources programs. They were all in. And then there was a Rasmussen poll that said 37% of Americans thought they might buy less Coke products. All of a sudden, they backed off those things, got rid of the critical race theory HR program, fired the lawyer who was in charge of that division, gave him a great severance agreement. He was a capitalist.
I think they paid him $6 million to come in and screw up their company for a few months. That's pretty good work if you can get it.
Yeah, he was a capitalist when it came to himself. He just wasn't a capitalist when it came to Coke.
That's right.
And now they backed off all of that. So there is real pressure out there, and it's causing companies to do things that just aren't in their best interest, aren't in the best interest of the American people. And it's an attempt, again, to get around our legislative process, our representative democracy. You know, they want to do through meetings with CEOs what they can't do at the ballot box. And that's a big problem.
Well, I'll just for disclosure purposes, use our own company's response as an example. We have been big shareholders in JP Morgan for a long time, and we still are. We run dividend growth equities at my firm, manage about $3.5 billion. And JP Morgan has been the outstanding dividend grower in financial services since the financial crisis. And if it weren't for the Fed dictating what they could do in capital return policy, they would have been an even more generous dividend payer. But with Jamie Dimon's stuff and some of the language that comes out about ESG and wokeism from time to time, I have to wince a little and roll my eyes. But I've talked to Jamie. I've talked to people at JP Morgan. I know from Jamie's record what he really thinks about this stuff. And we view it as a nuisance that they say stuff that is sort of obnoxious or you know, apologize about things said about the Communist Chinese, party, but that really when they're running their company, I think they're out doing what we want them to do. Coca-Cola, we were a large shareholder, also a tremendous dividend grower for a whole generation, but we sold every single share of what was about a $65 million position in Coca-Cola. The reason was it was real. They were actually not paying their law firms if their law firms couldn't show them diversity hiring practices retroactively. And they're in the middle of a $9 billion litigation with the IRS. they need to be paying their law firms. And my view of what happened with this person you were talking about was that that was a case of wokeism, not just being a press release, but actually being substantively damaging to shareholders. And so we made that decision to sell. It sounds like you're optimistic that if the good guys do enough pressure, the polling you talk about with Rasmussen, that a lot of these companies will end up turning because they're not as ideologically committed as we worry.
I'd say two things. Number one, you're investing and generating returns for other people. So you need to be very conscious of what how a company is behaving in that respect. Personally, I bought shares in BlackRock and I bought shares in Coke. And the reason I bought them is because I want to vote against the bastards. Yeah. I say, if you can be involved. You know, if you got $65 million worth of stock in Coca-Cola, vote the shares to get all those bums off the board of directors the next time they run. Yeah. So I'm a big advocate for staying involved with these companies as opposed to selling. But again, I'm investing for myself. I'm not investing right. for other people. But if I were investing for other people, I would feel differently.
You should connect with someone, Jerry Boyer, who I've had on the podcast twice. Also a man of faith, a deeply devoted, philosophically astute defender of free enterprise. But he's made this very point. And what they'll do is they'll go to shareholder meetings, and he's now figured out the way this stuff works. You can own 10 shares of Netflix and you're not going to go switch board votes, but they have to hear you. You know, they have to look at your question.
And I'll tell you, as a former CEO, I don't care how many shares you own. You stand up at a board meeting, you stand up at a shareholders meeting, you get hurt. You get listened to. And there's a guy named Justin Danhoff that's been doing this very successfully with very few shares across the country. His outfit is a not-for-profit, so he doesn't have a lot of shares, but he's been very effective and actually influenced what happens in the boards. One of those reasons is a lot of these CEOs really want their companies to be profitable. Now, I think the guy that runs Coca-Cola really has no idea what he's doing.
Yeah.
It's discouraging that they've managed to get Muhtar Kent before him, who was a very good guy. But this new guy, I don't think he has any idea what he's doing. I hope over time they'll get rid of him. But a lot of these CEOs like it when a shareholder comes in and says, "We object to your doing X," because the CEO didn't want to do it in the first place. Yeah. And this gives him, if he's got to talk to a Larry Fink or one of these other guys, it gives him a little ammunition to say, look, our shareholders at the meeting raised this and this issue. So I think we need to stay active. It's like when I hear people are dropping off of Twitter because, you know, Twitter is like censoring people. Hell, make them censor you. Be part of the company. I'm on Twitter because it's the only way I can reach liberals. I sort of look at this. I look at this a little differently, I think, than a lot of conservatives. I like staying involved in spaces that the left wants to occupy. And I encourage them, you know, censor me, cut me off, give me something to talk about. We've got to raise these issues and make these points. And on their turf is the best way to do it.
No, I think you're right. There's a courage it takes, but there's also a visibility and engagement that is going to be very constructive in the end. Well, let's switch gears a little bit here to talk. I mentioned before, in a perfect world, that you would have been our Secretary of Labor. And right now, labor markets, obviously, as an employer at a very large organization that employed a lot of people in the lower end of the wage spectrum, being in the fast food industry, you have a lot of expertise in this subject. But, you know, I guess traditionally we would go talk about minimum wage laws and what these ideas of $15 and $18 and $20 minimum wages, regardless of geography, cost of living, what have you, all the misunderstandings about it. I'm a real Milton Friedman disciple on this subject. I have a chapter in my book about it. But right now, we're not so much looking at the minimum wage issue as people post-COVID just not wanting to go back to work. And what the media has decided to call the Great Resignation, which I think is their way of almost trying to make it seem like a positive event that there are 54-year-old able-bodied men that have just decided to stop working at this juncture of life. Do you feel that both the 19 to 25 year old, which I assume CKE would have had a lot of experience in that demographic of hiring high school and college age people, but even in the more middle age demographic, do you see this declining labor participation force as big of a cultural problem as I do?
Yeah, it's a cultural problem and an economic problem. I think it will diminish as these benefits that were paid out during the pandemic also diminish, when savings start to decline, when the massive benefits that were passed by both Republicans and Democrats during the pandemic to get through the pandemic finally expire, when people then are compelled really to go back to work if they want to maintain their style of living. This is, you know, one of the reasons that Joe Manchin wouldn't vote for many parts of the Build Back Better plan was that Biden's plan was actually to continue providing benefits to people without a work requirement. Now, that might sound horrible, but you got to remember Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich, they're the ones who put these work requirements into place. And they were very, very effective in reducing the welfare rolls and getting people back to work. So less of a burden on the people who were working and increasing the number of people working. You know, when you think about it, coming out of the pandemic, what did we know? What did we know January of 2021, December of 2020? Well, we knew, one, that people had a ton of money. Savings were huge, way up, like double what they were prior to the pandemic. We distributed over $4 trillion. So people had a ton of money. Secondly, we knew supply chains were screwed up. We knew they were screwed up because, number one, businesses didn't know what to order. So the orders were way down. Warehouses were sitting vacant. They didn't, you know, people couldn't get goods because they weren't being manufactured, because people weren't working. We told people they couldn't work during the pandemic. So we knew we had a supply chain problem, and we knew people had a tremendous amount of money, which is going to mean there was going to be a lot of demand. Now, what wouldn't you do if you knew that in December and January 2021? What wouldn't you do to solve those problems? Well, you certainly wouldn't hand out $1.9 trillion additional dollars, which is what Biden and the Democrats did in March, to people to encourage them not to go to back to work for a longer period of time, which would, of course, further screw up the supply chain, because while you're enhancing demand, you're encouraging people not to work, which again makes it difficult for the supply chain to function. So Larry Summers, you know, who, as many of your viewers will know, was the Secretary of Treasury under President Clinton and the head of the Council of Economic Advisors for President Obama, Jason Furman from the Obama administration, Steve Rattner, an economist from the Obama administration, all said, don't pass that $1.9 trillion bill, because you're going to be encouraging people not to work. You're going to further screw up the supply chain. You're pouring gasoline on an already potentially a bonfire of inflation. Well, they went ahead and did it anyway. And first, of course, they said that inflation was transitory. Then they tried to convince us it was a good thing. Now they're trying to convince us it's all due to Putin. Well, it's not. It's due to the fact that they made this idiot move back in the early part of last year and added to the already over $4 trillion we'd spent another $1.9 trillion, which means we've spent $5.3 trillion.
So that additional $1,400 direct payment to individuals, which made up the lion's share of that $1.9 trillion, you were opposed to that idea, that direct handout of the additional $1,400.
Wrote about it, spoke about it, said, please don't. I agreed with Larry Summers. Whenever I can agree with Larry Summers, I figure I must be right, because we hardly ever agree.
Yeah. So, by the way, I think, as neo-Keynesians go, he is almost always a straight shooter. Where we disagree, it's in philosophy, but not in execution. He's a very consistent ideological thinker.
Now, just to give you an idea how bad things are, I find myself quoting Larry Summers and Bill Maher over the past few months, more than I've ever quoted either of them.
That's a good point.
Things are so bad that these guys are saying, hey, you know, things are screwed up, people. We need to stop this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and, you know, it's one of the reasons where I have a big concern about right-wing populism, because there were plenty of people on the right that wanted to do those $2,000 payments after we had done CARES Act, after we had done COVID. And look, people always get upset when I point this out about the former president, but President Trump was pushing for it big as well. And I think he was totally wrong. We can debate what they did at the time of COVID. And there are some things I think that were really effective and really quite interesting. Other things that maybe, and you know, I was always opposed to the forbearance issue and the mortgage side and so forth. So you could get into the weeds of some of the policy issues that were done. But that $1.9 trillion by last year, when the vax was already out, and the amount of money that had already been done in various forms of support programs, it's just incomprehensible. And I don't even believe it will prove to be long-term inflationary, because I think the velocity of that money is going to collapse, as it always has with excessive indebtedness, and instead end up being economically stagnant as the excessive debt forces down future economic growth. So we get both the short-term pain of all the various supply chain and inflationary things we deal with now, and then longer term, we've just straddled ourselves with more debt to have to deal with, which comes from future economic growth.
Yeah, have you ever heard of stagflation, right? I mean, this is talk about being back in the Jimmy Carter era. I do a graph every month. A buddy of mine named Jeff Chasney, who's a techie guy, and I put out this graph. It was in an article I had in Fox Business last week talking about the economy. And the graph, it shows the inflation rate and the rate of wage growth. And you literally can see when inflation starts to exceed wage growth. And it literally is March and April of last year. It's literally when they passed this $1.9 trillion bill, inflation surges and wage growth levels around. Wage growth has been great. It's been about 5%. Unfortunately, we've now got inflation that's almost 8%. The graph also covers the Trump administration before the pandemic, where we had a period where wage growth always, every month, exceeded inflation, which meant people were not only seeing bigger numbers on their checks, but they were worth more. Then you've got the pandemic, which skewed the numbers, although inflation was always below wage growth during the pandemic as well. But then coming out of it, we're out of it March last year, 2021, and for the first time in many, many years since the Obama administration, inflation exceeds wage growth, and American workers are paying the price.
So right now, in terms of the labor ramifications, you talk about wages, you talk about the inflationary side. Is there a risk that the people who go back to work when that savings evaporation takes place and just some of the cultural and economic dynamics play out as you describe? I don't know. Can you leave the workforce for a year or two and not come back in a little bit handicapped relative to other people?
Yeah, let me say, I want to say, yes, the answer is, I want to get to that. It's a problem. It's a big problem. But I also want to acknowledge, look, I worked with Steve Mnuchin and people in the Trump administration back when the pandemic was coming on. And there was an incredible fear about what was going to happen to the country economically. We'd never been through anything like this before. And I do think when we told people, and it wasn't the Trump administration that said this, it was 50 state governors, Republicans and Democrats, who said, you can't go to work. We're shutting it down. Unless you're an essential worker, you're not going. Well, we had to provide benefits. We wanted to make sure businesses didn't fold. We wanted to make sure people had jobs they could go back to. Did we overspend? Yeah, we probably overspent. Were we trying to be safe? Yes, we were trying to be safe. But now, as people are returning to work, there is a problem. And unfortunately, I think had President Trump been reelected, we wouldn't be encouraging leisure the way we're encouraging leisure now. He wasn't in favor of issuing those checks. I don't think he would have been in favor of doing so following an inauguration to a second term. I think we could have talked him out of it. But in any event, there's been a real change in the labor force. I talked to friends of mine who are in the restaurant sector, and they're telling me the work ethic changed during the pandemic. We can't get people to work. When we do get them to work, they don't want to work weekends. They don't want to work late. You know, you've really found a real change in America. So it's almost much more of a European attitude. And I think once these social welfare programs go away, wear down, and we're not dealing with them anymore, I think then you're going to see a change. But until that happens, I think we're going to be dealing with this issue for quite a while.
If you don't mind, because we're really so focused on the economics here, you're an entrepreneur and an advisor, and the economic advice is what I do for a living. But we both have convictions into the culture and whatnot. Do you have thoughts on the existential damage being done to people that take a lighter work ethic? This is something I just can't let go of, Andy. I think that it's totally understandable that we'd be focused on what it's going to do to GDP, what it's going to do to the labor participation force, to inflation. All of the metrics, all of the economics matter. But I really worry about the individuals that are being further removed from productive capacity, from usefulness, from purpose. I just can't see how that ends well if we don't restore a true value on the very idea of work itself.
You know, let me give you an example that from my personal history. I got my first job where I got a paycheck working at a Baskin Robbins in Chagrin Falls, Ohio. And it was, I think it was getting a dollar an hour, but I worked there about, I don't know, 8-9 months. You know, people kind of went in and out of the job. I was making enough money to take my girlfriend out on a date and get gas in my car without bothering my parents, and who didn't have much money. In any event, the owner of that franchise restaurant called me into her office after about a year on the job and held out a key and said, you are now the assistant manager. You're getting a 10-cent an hour raise and you're opening in the morning. And I got to tell you, I opened that restaurant the next morning. I'll bet within 20 minutes, it was the cleanest Baskin Robbins in America. You get the kind of confirmation of your worth. It's a kind of thing that keeps you off the street, that keeps you off of drugs, that keeps you in school. This confirmation that you are worth something, that what you do has value. And even at that Baskin Robbins level in high school, looking back, is probably the high point of my professional career, getting that promotion to assistant manager at a Baskin Robbins, because it meant so much to me. You don't get that, you know, if your parents are supporting you, if the government's supporting you, if you're not going to work. You don't walk away with that value, that self-work that comes from really from any job, low paying, high paying, where you are acknowledged as a human being who has value beyond just taking the next breath. I mean, it's something that I would hate to see young Americans lose, and I am very concerned that it is something they're losing now.
Well, I know it's been a few years since you've been gone from CKE, but let me ask you what the kiosk world would look like at CKE if you were still there. My read at McDonald's is that if people are going to come back and say they don't want to work as hard, if the government's going to force $20 an hour minimum wages, that the entrepreneurs are doing exactly what they ought to be doing, which is to efficiently serve customers in a way that is going to be most beneficial to the business. Do you think that we're also automating more of these things that could be done by labor because we've allowed this sort of decline of value on labor and the worth of the individual contribution? It seems to me companies have choices here.
They do. And I was often criticized for it. I mean, there was a big thing on, I think it was on Reddit or something, where they were saying I wanted to replace all our workers with automation, which I never said. I never wanted to do. I never wanted to replace our workers. In fact, I resisted the move to kiosk, because I wanted to keep people employed. But that really, the facts never really bother the leftist media very much. In any event, what employers will do, if you price labor higher than the market, if you price it higher than the point at which businesses can continue to be profitable. And with restaurants, you're talking maybe 1-3% profit margins, not 50%. But if you price labor above what people can afford, businesses can afford to pay, they will either reduce labor by any means possible, for example, making your current employees, trying to encourage them to work longer hours, shutting down so you're not open for as many hours, or automating, which is a huge alternative for employees in this day and age. Even in the restaurant sector, they now have machines that actually make burgers. It's not just ordering from a kiosk, which millennials seem to prefer, by the way, to dealing with the person behind the cash register. That was some of the interesting learning as we went through this. They're more familiar with their iPhones than they are with looking somebody in the eye and talking to them. But the effort to automate, the effort to reduce labor costs inevitably happens when you artificially increase the cost of labor.
That's right.
You know, during the Trump administration, we had 20 straight months where labor was up over 3%, and people kept returning to the labor force. Labor participation went up. It went down the entire Obama administration. It's been at what would be record lows under Biden if we were pre-pandemic. But under Trump, it was increasing, and wages were increasing, and people were coming off the sidelines to take jobs. So that kind of thing works. If you artificially increase wages, which is what's happening now with all these government benefits, you're limiting the labor force artificially, and therefore you're making labor more expensive. What you're going to find is the people will do whatever they can to reduce labor costs. And that's what we're seeing.
I have a little theory. You can tell me if there's a future fast food executive in me or not. I think that the kiosk actually allows someone who maybe almost feels shameful ordering like an extra side or an extra burger to a person, but it feels a little less guilty just doing it on the kiosk. So it causes them to up their average ticket size a little bit.
You're right. And, you know, you have to use a credit card when you do the kiosk as well. And it turns out that people spend more money when they use credit cards than when they pay cash.
Yeah.
So so you get a double win there. Not only do people feel less guilty, but they also end up using their credit cards.
That's interesting. Well, the other thing I wanted to talk to you about, and it has, I think, an ideological component, but then you have some practical experience in it. And it's more in the weeds, and our Capital Record listener base tends to be a bit more sophisticated financially. I'm very concerned about, and this is also coming from some on the right, certainly many on the left, the war on private equity, the war on financial markets and some of our capital market innovations that certainly do not render parts of free enterprise immune from risk. They don't render free enterprise immune from occasional failures, as any business would be subjected to. But because of innovations that come in the capital structure of a business, we're now being told that private equity itself has done more harm than good, a statement that it strikes me as borderline insane relative to what the data shows in the last 25, 30 years of job creation and business improvement that's come about from private, both equity and private credit. You've been involved in private market transactions. You are a very capable defender of free enterprise philosophically. How do you marry these two things together? What's your general take on private equity in the American capitalist system?
Private equity is a huge contributor to our country's prosperity and actually to the economic benefit of many people who are working class, middle class. You know, the pension funds across the country, pension funds depend on the returns from private equity to meet their obligations to pay benefits to their recipients. The pension fund investments are huge for these pension funds. My experience with private equity was absolutely positive. We were a New York Stock Exchange company in about 2008, 2009, when President Obama was elected. I began to question whether or not it was wise to be the CEO of a publicly traded company, because I thought that the SEC and the Obama administration, as they did, would come down hard on these publicly traded companies. We were also at a point in our company's development where we needed to invest money to remodel restaurants. We needed to make some substantial investments to get our brands to the next level. The market was not going to look fondly in 2008 and 2009 of our taking money, our profits, the money we made internally, and investing in growth as opposed to paying dividends. You know, you've got all these hedge funds out there. You've got all these investors that want you to take every penny you have, sell every asset you have, and pay them dividends so that they can walk away with some cash. I needed to invest in the business so that we could grow, hire more people, and take the business to the next level. So I went to a couple investment banker friends of mine and said, "Look, get me out of here. I need to go private so that I can invest in growing the business, in developing the business without the restrictions that would come from SEC scrutiny of, you know, every time I turn a corner, and also the scrutiny of these investors who were demanding that we give them money as opposed to reinvesting in the business. We went private with Apollo, which is a huge private equity firm. And over the next 3 years, we spent those funds and the company came out of it worth a whole lot more money. We employed a whole lot more people and we were a whole lot more successful. And it was really due to the fact that we found a private equity investor who was willing to take a risk on our company and let us spend the money up front, knowing that there would be a return on those dollars later.
But so you were free cash flow positive and positive EBITDA going into your transaction of going private.
Yes.
And then you enhance the business and you enhance jobs and you enhance growth. But I am mystified when a lot of private equity transactions are in a time of distress and the company could go under. Private equity comes in and puts some debt and some equity in the cap stack, allows the company to keep going. Very often they turn around, they reinvent, they heal. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes the companies are just bruised and battered and not able to come out of it. And the risk takers lost money. Toys R Us and some other things that we've seen like that. But I don't understand how private equity taking a shot at distress or taking a shot at improving a profitable company like yours, I am mystified as to what the evil is that is going on here.
Well, I think too many people watched the movie Wall Street with Michael Douglas and his comment about greed is good. Well, greed is not good, and greed is not the basis of free market capitalism. In fact, it's just the opposite. But the claims that, you know, that the people that bought Toys R Us were somehow greedy is ridiculous. Those people lost money. They famously lost money, which means it's going to be tough for them to get investments going forward. They lost money that investors had that banks and other credit facilities had lent to the company, which means the next project they have, they're not going to be able to borrow money as effectively as they did in the past. Toys R Us going under was a miscalculation by a private equity firm, and they paid the price. They paid it monetarily. They paid it in respect to lost opportunity, and they damaged their reputation. So the idea that they would go into this trying to bring a company down is absurd. It's like one of these Elizabeth Warren fantasies, you know, where she one day she believes she's a Native American. The next day she believes private equity is trying to destroy companies. It's hard to keep up with her. You're right. It is absurd.
I think Elizabeth Warren's claim about her Native American heritage is more intelligent than some of the things she said about private equity.
Yeah, and more honest.
More honest, yeah. Because it really does speak to this idea. When they talk about these guys come in, they put a bunch of debt on a business, and then the business fails because it can't service the debt and people lose jobs. There is so much incomplete information and naivete about how corporate finance works in that system of thought that I really actually think it's more fair and more gracious for me to say that they're being dishonest than to say that they're that stupid.
Yeah. Well, you'd be right about that. Look, if you're in the business of buying companies that are in trouble and then fixing them, even if you're right 75% of the time that you can do it, you're still going to be wrong 25% of the time. You know, you'll make money if you're right 75% of the time, but you're not going to be able to fix everything. And the idea that, you know, Elizabeth Warren is just, she's so off the planet. I'd actually almost rather have AOC in power than Elizabeth Warren, because I think she, as disconnected as AOC is from reality, she's more connected than Elizabeth Warren. But private equity is a definite benefit for the country economically. It's a benefit for pension fund recipients. It's a benefit for the businesses that are saved, and businesses that were going to die anyway. Well, you know, they last a little longer. Maybe they die, but it's not the fault of the private equity firm. It's a failure by the private equity firm.
And Andy, you're doing some of the best work in the country. I see you on PragerU. I know the speeches you're giving, articles you're writing, the organizations you're affiliating yourself with in this stage of your life and career, at reminding us the basics of free enterprise. You talked earlier about how free markets are only going to be effective if we're meeting the needs of others. their specialization or division of labor that markets allow and commandeer. I would add there's diversification. I think it's the great aspect of diversification. Instead of it being around race, class, and gender, we get to diversify around our passions and our skills and our talents, make for a more meaningful contribution to society. You're hitting all the right notes on free enterprise in a time where a lot of people are not. And the one area too that I think you're eminently qualified to keep hitting that all of us need to do a better job is heralding risk-taking as a good thing. Because when we demonize people who fail, it implies that risk-taking must have been a bad thing. And I look at, you use a positive example with Carl's Jr., and I hope as a lifetime Southern Californian, you'll forgive me that I refer to it as Carl's Jr., not Hardee's.
All right.
Yeah, this is our brand out here. But then Toys R Us and a lot of these businesses, Apollo, you know, was part of Chuck E. Cheese, which kind of failed. And then you look at Carl's Jr., which succeeded. This is consumer brand business. It is eminently volatile. There is a lot of risk. I want people taking risk around the next great fast food company and pizza company and entertainment company. The notion that we would demonize risk-taking has got to stop.
Yeah, there, you can't succeed unless there's a potential to fail. If there isn't a potential to fail, you can't possibly succeed. And that goes across the economic spectrum. So let's look at why does America have companies like Ford Motor Company? Why do we have Apple? Why do we have Google? Why do we have Microsoft? And you know, the let's stick with Bezos. I was criticizing him before, but let's talk about Jeff Bezos, who's maybe the wealthiest man in the world. He's certainly tremendously wealthy. Well, again, he didn't get wealthy from stealing from us. He got wealthy because he provided us with a tremendous benefit, the greatest distribution system in the history of the world. There's never been a country or a company that's ever come anywhere close to a distribution system as effective as Amazon. Why does that happen in America? Well, it happens in America. It starts out in garages, as Amazon did and as Apple did. And the reason is because people are willing to take risks with their future. They're willing to take great risks if there is potentially great benefit. And investors are willing to invest in a company that's very risky if there's a potential that they'll get great returns from that investment. So it's actually that risk that really drives our nation. And it isn't just the big companies. It isn't just Amazon and Apple. It's the local pizzas. You know, your local pizza restaurants probably got a young man or a young woman who decided to invest their life savings and see if they could make some money working for themselves. And they opened up a pizza joint or a Carl's Jr. or a Hardee's or a McDonald's. This is America. America is about taking risks. And Henry Ford, by the way, I think he went bankrupt two or three times before he succeeded with the Ford Motor Company. And if he didn't go bankrupt, he came darn close. You can get up again. You can succeed even though you failed, and you will benefit their. It's not like you take a risk and the government gets all the money if you succeed, as is the case in a socialist country, or where there's really no inspiration to take a risk. You know, Carl Karcher founded Carl's Jr. He had an eighth grade education, came from Northern Ohio, moved to California, you know, worked delivering food, noticed that a hot dog cart was buying a lot of buns. The hot dog cart came up for sale. He managed to scrounge together $237 to buy that by hawking his car. And his wife had $15 she was saving in her purse. This is 1941. And it ended up being almost a $2 billion company by the time I left. This is the Americans. This is how we become a great nation, and why other nations that don't have our kind of economic system really never succeed to the extent that we do. It's about risk. It's about the ability to fail and the incredible, incredible ability to succeed.
Well, that's a beautiful way to end it. And what I love is that you brought together the two things that are the mission of Capital Record. You're talking about the free enterprise ethos, the entrepreneurial drive. And you look at success stories of Carl Karcher, Carl's Jr. It is true. Bezos started Amazon in a garage, Jobs at Apple. These were people with risk-taking and an entrepreneurial, very small business drive. Now it's true. We can look at some of these companies with multi-billion dollar market caps. Case of Apple, you're even over a trillion market cap and tens or hundreds of thousands of employees. But what that did was the free enterprise mission. And then it came into the capital markets reality and the ability to scale a business that could now provide thousands of jobs as a result of the great conventions in our financial markets and debt and equity and these other things we're talking about. Free enterprise combined with capital markets is an ethos, it's a worldview, but it's a system that has created incredible prosperity and opportunity. And I really do thank you for your role in helping to defend it.
Well, thank you very much. That was very well said.
All right, Andy. We'd love to have you back again on Capitol Record.
Just let me know, David. Thank you.
Well, I really hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. It's one of the continued themes here at Capitol Record week by week is that I am probably the biggest fan of these conversations, my own contribution notwithstanding, just being able to listen to these guys. I cannot tell you how much I enjoyed hearing Andy there, an eloquent defense of free enterprise, a careful rehash as to why free enterprise enhances the quality of life for humanity, bold and cogent critique of the ESG world and the ESG fallacy, a defense of private equity, an explanation of labor shortages and what it means to our culture and economy. There's just so much good stuff that came out of that talk. I hope you enjoyed it and can appreciate the work that Andy's doing and pray that we have more successful executives that are themselves eating the fruit from the tree of free enterprise, but instead will become defenders and appreciators, gratitude filled for this great engine of prosperity we have, as opposed to people that decide to critique the idea of free market capitalism. Thank you, as always, for listening to Capitol Record and for sharing this with everyone you can, for subscribing, reviewing, rating. We desperately want your feedback, and we want to make this the very best podcast out there for those interested in the cause of a free and virtuous society.